here today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, and to have another conversation about some of the stories that matter. Folks, there have been so many stories that have come out this weekend. It has been a busy weekend of stories talking about young people planning a potential Columbine, what's happening within our city and all the crime that's increasing, what's going on down at the border, what's happening with SB 8 in Texas, and what does this mean for President Joe Biden's term? They're saying this is the make or break week for him. We're going to cover all of that in our weekend roundup roundtable taking place in the first hour. In the second hour, we want to delve deep with you into talking about Baltimore City and talking about violence and talking about what is happening with COVID-19 in the schools. So we're going to go national to local. Give us a call, 410-319-8888, at any time to join in the conversation. I'm joined now by Trey Lewis, a freelance writer based in Texas, who joins us on a regular basis to kind of talk through the news. Trey, how are you?
I'm doing well, young lady. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. So why don't we start with what's happening with what they're calling these natural-born killers? There were some teenagers in Pennsylvania who have been accused of plotting to shoot up a Pennsylvania high school on the anniversary of Columbine, which is not until April 20th. What turns to be so interesting about this is that it's one of the parents of one of the teenagers who turned in the group. What we're starting to see is more teenagers are looking for ways to express themselves in what seems to be violent lens that they're using to look at themselves. Can you tell us what you think about what's happening with the teens who are now plotting to do a Columbine-style attack on top of the teens that just shot up in the last couple of weeks?
Well, one, I think we should first applaud the parents of the member, one of the members of the group, because, you know, I don't know if we could count on that type of reliance on the parents, you know, 15, 20 years ago, meaning to say that people are taking more serious when these people are displaying, or teenagers are displaying, very disturbing, organized entities that are going to be violent and about harming and killing people. So I think that's the first step, is that people are being proactive when they recognize those signs. The second part is, of course, why are these things happening en masse in the first place? And I think it's because, you know, earlier on in some of these teenagers or child's lives, they felt whatever they felt, ostracized or whatever. That's what it generally comes from. People, you know, teenagers who feel as though they're on the outskirts of their social world or what have you. And, you know, exploring ways and why that is the case. And developing structures and developing systems in place to look at why these things take place so much is also very important. That thing that will also obviously take a much longer and more developed path. But I think the first path is recognizing when these things are taking place and immediately taking action, as opposed to waiting. And then we all know what happened. Well, someone, they were warned before it happened. So before that happens, it's good that we're at least being proactive more. And that's the first start.
What I think is interesting is that when we look at these four Pennsylvania students and their plan to kind of attack their high school, their goal was to attack it on the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre. So they're planning now for an attack that they want to have happen in 2024. I think the ways in which they're going about charging these students, perhaps we need to step back a little bit. I mean, you're talking, it's 2021. They're planning out to 2024. They're charging two of the students as adults. Two of them are 15 years old, so they're being charged as adults. The other two, 11 and 12 years old, of course, are being charged as, they are younger, so they're being charged as adolescents. But what I think is really fascinating about this is that their reason behind this is that they don't like school, They don't like anything happening in school. They're unhappy with the school environment, that instead of charging them, Trey, could this have been a situation where we offer counseling? Even though they had, the way it's standing here, they had weapons of mass destruction. Okay. They used terroristic threats with the intent to terrorize. They're being charged with aggravated assault, possession of explosive materials, engaging in criminal conspiracy. But all I'm saying is, because it was something they were planning for 2024, was there another way that we could have intervened besides just arresting him? Or maybe arresting him is the only way to send a message.
Well, I think it's a situation. I mean, you're right. I think the time period isn't as important. Personally, I don't think it's as important as to what it is, because that's right. What terroristic bombings or terror generally is. It takes planning. So they're generally not going to do it next Tuesday. They are going to plan to do something that's lofty in the future. I also agree with you that, you want to, I mean, they are very young, obviously. They're not even adults. They are teenagers and preteen at 12. And then you say, well, there has to be, we need to do a little bit more as adults to, like you said, do a little more counseling, do a little more harder work than just arresting them. On that same token, you do want to also make it very clear to anyone else, to these copycat people that might be scattered in Pennsylvania or across the country as a whole, you want to make it very clear that this isn't going to be tolerated, and that if you are going to try to do these things, you need to be careful not to put these things in the public or in the open, because they will be monitored and they will be addressed. So I think it's a multifaceted approach, just like with anything with dealing with children. But you want to make it so that you want to make sure that, you know, there's a deterrent factor, but you also want to make sure there's a counseling factor as well. So that is something that it won't happen again. So you won't have to worry about a deterrent going forward.
They're definitely going hard, because the two that are being charged as adults, the two 15-year-olds, are being held without bail. So yeah, there's definitely not a lot of wiggle room. But I wonder if our response, and I'm thinking our as adults, if our response right now is only further highlighting the gap that exists between adults and children. Mm-hmm. I say that on the edge of this recent TikTok challenge, which is the controversial Devious Lick challenge, where they were challenging each other to steal the unstealable from schools. You know, clocks and doorknobs. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Someone stole a box of masks, right? So they challenge each other on TikTok. But the new challenge, which is coming out in October, is to slap a teacher. Mm-hmm. Try to slap a teacher and get away from the teacher as quickly as possible. I think of both of these challenges along with the milk crate challenge. My problem with the milk crate challenge, to back it up, that was not just teens. Although we're now saying, well, teens are doing too many challenges. I saw adults, grown folks, doing this milk crate challenge and giving teens and others the 5 minutes of fame. So if the milk crate challenge led to all of this fame for people who were able to actually cross over, why wouldn't you expect teenagers to pick up on that, and they have to keep raising the bar?
I agree. Right. But I think it's also important to know that I know we're seeing this in time in 2021 and we're thinking this is a phenomenon, but there's always been a plethora of people doing stupid things, young, old. It's just now we have social media to see it in Cincinnati and in California and across the country, as opposed to just knowing that, you know, Joe down the street jumped off the roof and tried to jump in the pool or something. So there's always been stupidity. It's just that we're now seeing it live. And then what is also disturbing is that these kids are emboldened to not only do these things against adults. I mean, they might be teachers, but they're still adults and they're still children. What is troubling, though, not that they're doing stupid things, but they're doing violent, stupid things, and they're letting it be known who they are that they're doing it. You know, so that, to me, that is a very disturbing thing, because you as a 14, 15-year-old years of age are, you know, your social media account is attached to you, and you are boldly doing this and participating in something, and the whole world knows who you are and you don't care. That is troubling to me, because that means that there's no consequences for, or they know there's no consequences for what they're going to do.
So Trey, are the children okay? We're talking about young people that are in the midst of a global pandemic. I was going to say they're coming out of it, but they're in the midst of a global pandemic. Mm-hmm. Still don't have adequate vaccines for the 5 to 11-year-old population, yet we've put them back in school. We have aptly informed them by our actions that whatever happens, happens, because you need to be in school. They've watched the way we've handled climate changes, the way we've handled even this level of respect towards one another. They've watched all this play out in real time. And so why are we surprised when they do these devious lick challenges, when they want to slap a teacher?
Mm-hmm.
Seeing as a way to express themselves in the midst of what feels like a very frustrating situation.
I say also that there's been frustrating situations for all of us. I mean, as a teenager, I was a teenager a while ago, but it wasn't that long ago. And there were teenagers in the time of the Depression. There were teenagers in World War. There were teenagers during the time of Civil Rights. There's always been trauma and violence and craziness going on in the world. That is also we can't be surprised that it's reflective of our youth. I agree with that. But I still have to be concerned that they're so bold and to not care that they're known to be that they're going to be doing these things. That to me is very disturbing, because as a young person, you don't understand the jeopardizing the things that you're doing that could mess you up for years to come, just because you participated in some stupid challenge. So I think also, we're failing to put consequences and concrete structures in place to young people in medical to be known that if you do certain things, you know, certain things are going to be harder for you in the future. But you're right. We also, as adults, also have to create an environment to show them that, you know, these things are respected in the adult world, and that there is decorum, and that there is respect, and that there is civility, even amongst all the craziness that you may see. So you're right. It's twofold, but I can't ignore the acts of the young people, and I can't excuse them because of the ills of the world. Because I think the emboldened state to me is very alarming.
Now, interesting, Trey, because I had an opportunity to visit with my youngest son. And he was talking about how hard things are for young people today. and I did similar to what you said. I said, you know what? There's always been challenges. It's been hard all the way through. I said, yes, it might be difficult. I said, but think about the children coming through the civil rights movement, who when they left home, their parents had the idea they might not come back home. And right. And he heard me. I'm sure he heard me. He's like, Mom, it just feels like it's more. And so I started thinking about that. I'm like, are we putting a lot more on young people? Even though we know 100 years ago, they did have the 1918 flu pandemic. I'm just wondering, with COVID-19, on top of the climate issues, on top of Black Lives Matter, on top of what's happening with the Trumplicans, on top of what's happening with the Biden presidency, on top of what's happening with Senate Bill 8, Senate Bill 4 in Texas, it does, mm-hmm. even as an adult, it feels like there is a lot going on in this country right now.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is. But I think what you're also seeing is, unfortunately, because we're in the point that we are in history, we're seeing the failure of prior people who simply didn't do enough. They didn't do enough when they had a chance in civil rights to truly go the extra mile and truly get things right. They didn't do enough in history in regards to environment and making sure emissions were in check and stop urban sprawl. They didn't do enough as far as, you know, drug reconciliation and reorganizing the war on drugs, or so-called war on drugs. You know, it's unfortunate they are seeing this, but I mean, the thing is that there's other generations right behind them, or should they right, the immediate predecessors that are also feeling the brunt as well. Mm-hmm. The young adults, young working adults, people my age bracket, millennials and such, we're also feeling the brunt, and we're in the workforce, and we're still not able to do anything about the immense amount of problems that plague our country.
Let me bring, let me bring Denise Clay. She just joined us. Denise Clay is a reporter, columnist, editor for the Philadelphia Sunday Sun. She has a column there. She's a Philadelphia, she works for the Philadelphia Magazine. She has a column there called Everyday People. She's a frequent guest on the show. Denise, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I want to just ask you the question that Trey was answering and just kind of pull it together. Are the children okay? Are we failing the children today?
Failing is a really strong word, but I think in this case, in some ways, it has to apply. We have a lot of kids dealing with untreated trauma. And some of that is being brought on by the fact that, let's face it, kids have not actually been allowed to be just kids for a very long time now. And until we address that, until we stop making our young people be not quite so young as early as possible, it's going to be too much on them. But the thing is, they have to know what's going on. It just helps if there's a parent or an adult that they trust there to help them make sense of it all. Because a lot of, I bump into a lot of kids who watch the news or read certain things or get on the internet, and you can tell there is no one there to help them understand what they're looking at, what they're reading, what they're seeing. And we need to do better about that.
I'm glad you said that. And Trey, I want to ask you, because when we start talking about this oversight, it came out that China at this point has gone so far as to put a limit on how much young people in China can watch TikTok. I think it's like 40 minutes a day. Like, they are really starting to limit social media usage for children with the idea to turn them away from this addiction that seems to be growing. Is China onto something? Is that something we should really start to consider doing here in the United States? Since parents won't do it or can't do it, is it time for the government to step in and, like, mandate some type of rules around social media use for children?
No, I don't agree with that. That's just the 2021 version of video games are making our kids violent. It goes to what Denise is saying, is that there is parts of it that is our fault as adults. We are failing on the crucial issues that are the brunt is being weighed down to the young people. Particularly, we think about what the environment they're now going to have to face going forward. Very extreme, unpredictable weather patterns, which when we were kids, we didn't have to worry about. So the thing is that I don't believe also that it's something where we need to overly police. We already have enough rules and regulations in place. So all you have to do is just have simple filter measures, which is in place on across a lot of platforms, in which you can just simply filter these things out. But I don't believe in a complete banning or handcuffing of kids. I think that goes into what Denise said before, is that I think that goes into not allowing kids to be kids. I mean, we understand that there's certain things that they shouldn't be allowed to do or have access to. But in that same token, we can't overly police and overly restrict everything in which they don't allow them to fund. Because and the last thing is that as much bad comes from social media, there's been even more good in social media as far as kids enjoying each other and connecting by just making silly dances and having kids and being kids and enjoying each other and doing that. So that's largely overlooked, that most of this stuff is used for kids to be kids. And I think we can't allow that to be overshadowed by the people who don't want to use it for that and want to use it for bad means and ruin it for the other kids to have fun. I think that's very important. That should be known as well.
So, Denise, I want to ask you now as we move the conversation along here. So last week, we were in the midst of dealing with the unfortunate loss of Gabby Petito. And what came out after that, of course, was this conversation around the missing white woman syndrome, the terminology that was coined by the great Gwen Ifill, to talk about the way the media and the public gets overly involved, concerned, consumed when a white woman goes missing. So it's been talked about a lot in the media, and we're now starting to see a little bit of backlash about that, with saying that, you know, why is it that in this situation, why are black folks bringing race in when a young woman is missing? Have you been talking because about this, covering this? Go ahead.
Because there's an organization called Black and Missing that had to be put together, because when young black girls would go missing, when young black girls went missing, no one cared. And it's not even so much a function of no one, it's not just the media not, you know, giving it coverage or giving it notice. It's not just that, unless it's a child. Now, you know, Releisha Rudd in Washington, D.C., the little girl that went missing that no one has found yet, you know, that got a lot of coverage because she was a child.
Right.
But why is it that for black, Latino, Asian, Native American girls, when they go missing, why do they have to be children for them to get any kind of notice? There is a Native American group that's been, you know, that's taken the whole Gabby Petito thing and used it as an opportunity to bring up the fact that there are, like, Native girls going missing from reservations that no one is even talking about. So if you have a problem with us calling it missing white woman syndrome, and you have a problem with us bringing race into the conversation, then how about looking at how we treat missing people, period? Because I'm not even sure if the media coverage doesn't influence how police look at it.
Right.
I mean, because let's face it, everybody and their mama was looking for Gabby Petito, and they should have been. They even pulled out John Walsh, former host of America's Most Wanted, who now has another show called In Pursuit Of or On the Hunt For or something. I haven't seen it, so I can't remember the name right now. But when they pulled him out, and he gave a nickname to the parents, calling them of the guy that's accused of killing her fiance Brian Laundry, you know, calling them the dirty laundry. You don't see that for young girls of color that go missing.
Right.
You don't see John Walsh isn't pulled out. You don't see the gavel to gavel nationwide coverage.
Like a miniseries. It was like a miniseries.
Right. I mean, you don't see any of that stuff. And the thing is, what people need to realize is that our missing children, our missing girls, our missing boys, our missing men and women, they are just as important to us as yours are to you. And if you don't want us to talk about how race plays a part in this, then how about making it so race doesn't play a part by looking for everyone and giving everyone the same kind of media attention when these things occur?
All right, so Denise, we got to take a hard break there, folks. I'm on with Denise Clay and Trey Lewis. When we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, what's happening on the border. Talk about Texas women are crossing state lines to get abortions. We have a lot more to talk about in the second half of the show, and the phone lines are open to you, so stay with us. Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. I'm on with Trey Lewis, a freelance writer based in Texas, and Denise Clay, a reporter, columnist, and editor based in Philadelphia, going through the weekend and last week's news, just kind of giving a roundup to some of the stories that have come out. Trey, I wanted to just touch bases with you before we move on, because we were talking about the missing white woman syndrome, something that Denise said I wanted to just highlight, that last year, from 2020 to now, 543,000 people have gone missing. 40% of them are people of color. We don't make up the majority of the population, but we do make up a majority of people who are missing, and no one tends to sound the alarm in the way that, say, they sound the alarm for Gabby Petito. She's not the only one. She's just the most recent one with over 200 million hits on TikTok. Everybody was looking for her. Life stopped. And now there's white lash. That terminology was, you know, coined by the New York Times. There's white lash. People are wondering, why are we bringing race into it when a family is grieving?
Right. Well, I think what's important, I think the addressing that there is an oversympathetic case for when it comes to missing people, that it is catered, is whitewashed. I mean, first it starts with, there's none better than Little White Girl Missing. Little White Girl Missing is a national tragedy. Then it goes up to Little White Kid, General, and then White Woman. And the reason for this that no one really addresses is because you got to look at who is putting the coverage out there, the media outlets. Well, who tells the media outlets what to do? It's the producers who are at these media outlets, who are 99% of the time white. And so in order to change this coverage, that's the first start, is changing the coverage. To change the coverage, you have to change the people who are telling the coverage. Now, we're helped now because we have social media. We're able to do this on our own. But to have the same energy and the same impact that a news outlet has, a CNN can have, where they can reach, you know, one broadcast can reach 20 million people in one swoop, you have to change or demand that these producers put as much coverage and attention and care and correspondence and what have you and resources in finding, you know, a missing white woman as they do a missing black woman. Because that's where the change will happen. It won't happen unless the coverage changes. Because we'll keep talking about this for decades until the coverage changes and is equal across the board.
Well, then with that, Denise, let's talk about what happened down the border, on the border with Haitian migrants. So there is a concern now. And a lot of people saw the photograph of the Border Patrol officers on horseback, looking like they were holding whips. They later said those were reins, not whips, trying to pull people out the water, men, women, and children. And the world was outraged. Maxine Waters was screaming. Reverend Al Sharpton was down with them. Everybody was outraged within the black community because for a number of people, it drew comparisons to the slave paddy rollers and enslaved people running away in an attempt to steal themselves to be free. Well, now they're saying, well, if we don't use horses, we're going to have ATVs. Should we have shot them? You know, what do you expect us to do? And that the Border Patrol officers no longer feel protected because they felt that the president did not stand up for them and the work they were doing. Can you talk a little bit about how that situation has unfolded and maybe some of the impact of that that will be felt down the road?
Well, first of all, what we need to start off before we do anything else is we need a comprehensive and able to be understood immigration policy, because I don't think America has had that for a very, very long time. You also need to start explaining to people in law enforcement, particularly places like the Border Patrol that was basically allowed to go nuts during the Trump administration. You need to explain to these people before they become law enforcement officers that the reason you become a law enforcement officer is not to be able to arbitrarily abuse people under color of law. When you see people on horseback, you know, and I'm sorry, if it looks like a whip and, you know, you can tell me it's a rein all you want, I've seen reins. My grandfather trained horses. I've never seen a rein that looks like a whip. I just haven't. And, you know, if this is what you're going to do and the only choice is ATVs and shooting people, that tells me that you're in the wrong line of work, that you got into the business for the wrong reason. And, you know, you maybe need to find another job before you kill somebody and think you should get away with it because you're doing it under cover of law. But we need to have an immigration policy that makes sense, that is fair to everybody, that says that, you know, Cubans that come on the land in Florida, you know, under the old wet foot, dry foot policy are going to be, you know, are going to be made to leave, just like we do Haitians when they do the same thing. And we also, as a community, need to understand that when we're talking about immigration, we are also talking about Black people. A lot of times, Black people ignore immigration because they think it's just their our Latino brothers and sisters or our Asian brothers and sisters. No, there are Africans and there are Haitians that are in this mix of people who are, you know, currently being incarcerated in deportment camps along the border. And we need to understand this because until we get in the game, folks, like you're going to see more of that kind of stuff that you saw,
right?
With these pictures, because let's face it, if the person that was being chased with the whip were Latino, the Latino community would have been so up in arms, they'd have taken to the streets almost immediately. We need to understand as a community that immigration includes us, too, and we need to act accordingly.
I like the way you said that, Denise. Trey, how do we get Black folks to understand that this is our image? This is our issue. This is a cause we should take up. I know for a number of people, they were actually surprised to learn about what was happening under the bridge. They were surprised to see the Haitian migrants. They were surprised about the horses. And they actually said, what's going on? I thought it was. And they filled in the blank with the type of people they thought would be there and not Black bodies.
Right. I think, but also first, I think the first thing you need to do is before, and this is on purpose, this issue has become an immigration policy issue where it really isn't on the forefront. It's really a humanitarian issue. Mm-hmm. The people, the Haitian people that are trying to relocate are relocating primarily because of natural disasters that took place in their country. So they're not even trying to set up shop here. They're just simply seeking permanent shelter and resources so they can piece their life back together. So I think, and then what has happened, though, of course, is American media has interjected a wedge issue, which is immigration policy, gets everyone yelling, where we've overlooked the humanitarian policy. Because basically, essentially, these people are being treated just like we see poor Black people treated after natural disasters, whether it's Hurricane Katrina up to most recently Hurricane Ida. So it's the same thing, but it's just being done by people who speak French.
Right.
But it's the same policies, which is that if you're poor, Black or brown, we do not care to truly resurrect your situation to get you whole, which wasn't that much to begin with, but we don't even care to get you back to that level. And so that is what we've always been talking about in this country. And we need to understand that this is a policy issue that is rooted in America, not just for domestic issues, but also for how they treat other Black and brown people around the world.
But do you think this is going to have a long-standing impact, Denise, where when we had this pushback against the treatment with police officers, you had police officers pulling back, not wanting to do their work, not wanting to engage, not showing up, particularly in economically challenged Black communities. Do you think we may see the same kind of pushback here with Border Patrol officers?
I wouldn't be surprised if we did. Because let's face it, when you've had at least 4 years of being treated like you are allowed to go above and beyond what the law says, when someone tells you, no, you can't do that, like any unruly five-year-old, you're going to throw a tantrum. And the tantrum in this case is going to be like a scale back of, you know, people coming to work or people doing their work or whatever. And the thing is, you know, that also tells me that you got into this business for all the wrong reasons. And one of the things that I've been, you know, trying to do some research on because of Philadelphia and its issues with not only police brutality but with the murder rate is how do we determine in terms of mental health evaluations who becomes a law enforcement officer? Do we do a good job evaluating mental health when it comes to police officers? Because you would think that with all of the stuff like this that goes on, that we're not weeding out people who want to do this for all the wrong reasons. And we need to do that.
So now, with that in mind, as we're going forward, and I know I'm going to ask you to kind of, both of you, to look into your crystal ball here as reporters, but researchers are now saying that it seems like things are lining up in such a way that Donald Trump is definitely going to be the 2024 Republican nominee. And if so, what do we put in place to push against it? I mean, one of the arguments I was making is, like, we got to get more excited about these midterm elections. We need Democrats to come out for the midterm elections on the way to the presidential election, not just waiting until 2024. We need them excited and showing up in the same way they showed up with the election of President Joe Biden to keep things moving in this direction. What do you think, Trey? I mean, people seem to have kind of tuned off and it's back to business as usual with President Biden, kind of waiting for a decide and announce, going on about their life with the idea, you know what, President Biden has it. I don't have to be as involved as I was when Donald Trump was in office.
I'm still afraid of the 75 million. The 75 million people who voted to uphold the Tyrannic state. I don't think there's a political science word to describe what we experienced under the Trump administration. So we need to be very careful that there are 75 million people who are waiting in the wing, and they would gladly vote for Donald J. Trump today if they had the opportunity. And they're definitely going to have the opportunity probably in 2024. So on our side, we need to do two things. We need to entrench even deeper people to come out and be registered and vote in the large turnout numbers they did in 2020 to ensure that we don't have the disaster that we had in 2020 and the 4 years prior happen again. And then secondly, this is on the Biden administration. I'm not going to get on them too hard because we're still only in, you know, the ninth month of his administration. However, they need to start shaping up the country off of bold policies that we can, what we were talking about earlier, things that we won't have to be talking about as dire going forward. They need to make a bold statement on the environment. They need to make a bold statement on federal laws and criminal laws and drug reform. They need to make a bold statement on protecting women's rights. They need to make a bold statement on protecting voting rights. So that will energize people, hopefully. But I am fearful. I'm not going to lie, because the Trump magnet is real. It's probably as magnetic as the Earth magnetic field, because it attracts the worst of the worst, and they will turn out in huge numbers to support Trump. We just need to have more. And I think there is. You just need to have people motivated to do it.
Denise, what do you think? I mean, this real concern around the potential Republican nominee, which if we continue down this vein, the Trumpicans are getting stronger and more organized. January 18th aside, I mean, they've moved things a little bit more offline, so they are organizing a lot more. What are some of the concerns that you have?
Well, I'm originally from Pemberton, New Jersey, which is not too far from Atlantic City, and those of us in New Jersey have already seen, we saw before the rest of the country and the rest of the world saw Donald Trump completely mess things up. We saw it first, and we tried to warn you, and we really wish you would listen.
Right.
But I say all that to say, one of the things that I always tell people when, you know, they talk to me about elections, I say, here's one bet you should never make with me, and that bet is, I bet the American people are not going to go to a voting booth and do something totally ridiculous. Mm. Because in 2016, that's exactly what they did. They went into a voting booth, and they did something totally ridiculous. You had all of these people who thought that Hillary Clinton had it in the bag,
yes,
because there was no way that the American public would elect the host of Celebrity Apprentice. And what we found out is that you had just enough people who were already, who had gone through what I call the Obama aneurysm, where they were so mad about this black man getting two terms in office,
right,
that, you know, they had, you know, a blood vessel burst. You had so many people having the Obama aneurysm come out and vote, and they're still with us. I have to agree with Troy. The 75 million people who did not think that having the equivalent of a Russian operative,
right,
in the nation's highest office wasn't a deal breaker. The people who thought that having said equivalent of a Russian operative endorsed by David Duke, the former Grand Dragon of the United Clans of America, was not a deal breaker. The people who thought that it was okay for the person holding America's nation's highest office to go around telling people to drink bleach instead of put on masks and practice social distancing in the face of a pandemic, even after he refused the COVID test that the World Health Organization offered us so that we could get in front of this epidemic because they saw what was happening everywhere else. The fact that there are 75 million people who thought that was okay, still think it's okay, and had no problem going to the nation's capital and try to stop the certification of the vote for president, something that has never been done in our history. The fact that those people still exist is scary, and we need to stay on. And those of us who don't want to cover that again or don't want to see that again need to stay on top of it because it could happen again. I mean, the Republican Party is definitely afraid of this man. And because of that, anybody else that they could put up to challenge him for president is not going to do it because they are deathly afraid of not only this man, they are deathly afraid that he will sic his voters on them.
Yes. That's what it comes down to. It's the amount of voters that he has under his control who actually believe that Donald Trump, all the things you just said, notwithstanding all of that, Donald Trump is the one that speaks for them, speaks to them, and will work on their behalf. Like, there's an absolute committed belief that Donald Trump is the answer to everything they are struggling with when it comes to race, when it comes to class issues, when it comes even to gender issues, birth race. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump's going to answer all of that, Trey. Yeah.
It's insane. We haven't seen this. I'm not using hyperbole. I don't think we've seen this in the numbers that we have where they elected a president, a devious populist like Donald Trump, the Trump vote, I should say. The Trump vote has literally trumped all other reason and logic that you could possibly string together because it's fiddled together with, it's the best way, comedian said it best, it's essentially the comment section of Facebook becoming president. Yeah. And the people who think that if you take, you know, horseworm medicine, you can cure yourself of COVID. Yeah. People who think that your hearing is affected by wearing a mask. People who think there's a caravan of whatever coming to America every day in the millions. These people are a lot of people, and they're going to vote for Trump because he is them, and they are he.
Right.
And it is an inseparable marriage that is, will happen again. I do know our numbers, meaning people who are of the reason of the country. I know our numbers are higher. We just have to duplicate that again. I just fear that it might not come to that, but, you know, we'll see. But I really think that we do have the numbers. I don't believe that we have the people in place to get those numbers out. That is what I really believe.
Well, black folks, Denise, are leaving the country. Let me just throw something out to you. Because Ghana has come forth and said that when George Floyd was murdered, they saw an uptick in the number of calls regarding black folks from America saying, hey, kid, what's the process for us moving there? And since then, in the last year, over 5,000 black folks have relocated to Ghana. Do you think that's the answer for us to get out of this country?
Okay, I can either answer that as a journalist or I can answer that as a military brat whose father fought for this country for 32 years. Mm. As a journalist, you know, if there's an argument that can be made for that because America has not been very kind to us from the moment that our ancestors were dragged here, not of their own volition. America has not been kind to us. And it, you know, I could understand why people might say, you know something, I've had about enough of this, and I want to try something else. Now, as an Army brat whose father spent 32 years in the United States military defending the country, you're not getting me out of here.
Mm.
My family gave it the office. And, you know, my dad fought in every war in the 20th century except for the Gulf War. And, no, I'm sorry. You don't get to take a country that my father literally put blood, sweat, and tears into and take it away from me or anybody else who is a descendant of people, of the people who actually built this country. Because let's keep it real. Were it not for the forced labor that you all managed to import
right.
from Africa, the American economy would not be what it was. The American economy would not be what it is, because you can make a whole lot of money when you have a workforce that you don't have to pay. And there'd be a whole lot of things that, you know, you all praise as, you know, oh, I'm a patriot and this is my patriot building, that would not exist were it not for us. So while I understand why people might want to repatriate, and believe me, my husband and I have discussed this. It has definitely been something we've talked about. But my people did more than a lot of the folks that are running around here talking about make America great again will ever do to make this country attempt to even be a shadow of what the Constitution said it was supposed to be. So, you know, you're not getting me up out the pain. It's just not happening.
Okay. Now, before I have you answer that, Trey, folks, give us a call, 410-319-8888. Black folks are leaving the country. And I know 5,000, of course, no way taps into the numbers, makes a real dent in our numbers here. But it is something that we should look at about whether or not we're saying, look, those who have the means, right, Denise, not everybody can go. You got to have the means to be able to pack up, pack your family, get the airplane tickets, have money when you get there, go through the process so everybody won't be able to go. But is that the answer for black folks to move up out of here? I'm going to go to Trey, and then Trey, we have Elaine and Clark holding. So I'll go to you first, and then we'll get our callers.
Well, I think it depends upon what your goals are or what you feel as though your goals are. If you're a black person in this country, you say, you know, I don't really feel attached to America, period. I just want to live somewhere that's free, to where I'm not going to judge by my skin. Then, by all means, go somewhere else. But if you really believe that you have a place to undo the wrong that has been done against black people in this country and really across the world, going to another country won't fix that, because, as I said earlier, our policies are racial-based, not just domestically but internationally. So the damages, now granted, they won't be as first person because they won't be as direct. But the fact is that many nations around the world suffer because of American policies, whether it be, I don't know, a country just south of us like Cuba because of our economic sanctions against them, or our environmental disasters that we cause in countries like Indonesia because we are crop cash farming, things of that sort, where the world is suffering because of American policies. You're just going to go to somewhere else where you're just going to get another version of that.
Mm.
So I agree. It's best to me personally to stay here and right the wrong, because this is our country. Whether you served in the military or not, whether you voted or anything, even if you didn't ever vote, if you're just a citizen in this country is just as much as yours as everyone else's.
All right, let's get to some callers. I like what you're saying here, Trey. Let's get to Elaine, and then we'll go to Clark. Elaine from Ellicott City, how are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. I just have three things I'd like to say, is that this is our country. I heard someone else. My father fought in World War II, and he had to persevere and attend school even when he had to leave town. And he had to leave town to finish high school while his parents were still paying for white kids to finish high school. So anyway, aside from that, this is our country. We built this country. And I have one issue. Why are we still talking about President, I shouldn't say President Trump, Donald Trump? He's not a person. He's an evil spirit. And we're actually doing a disservice, and to even call up his name, we should just completely forget about him and move on. And another issue I have, I want to know what happened to the church leaders. The church leaders are not speaking up about any injustices that are happening now. You know, the treatment of the Haitians. I haven't heard a word, not from my pastor or any other pastors, and talking to friends, they have not said anything about what's going on as far as police brutality, our sons and daughters being killed. What happened to the black church? And I know we're part of the black church, the African-American church. What happened to the leaders? I can only think of one leader in the church that happens to be in Alexandria, Virginia, who's speaking up about it. I haven't heard anything on the news, and that's all I have to say.
Thank you so much. Elaine, you put a lot on the table, and I think we're going to have to address all of that when we come back from the break. Why are we still talking about President Trump? Where are the faith leaders? I'm on with Denise Clay and Trey Lewis. I have Clark and African Holding. Hold on. We'll come back from the break. We will answer Elaine's questions, and then we'll get to your callers right after the break.